From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Carole King wrote many top 40 hits in the 1960s. Then in the 70s, her album Tapestry became the best-selling album of the decade. King has a new album, and on today's Fresh Air, Carole King talks about writing hits for the Shirelles, the Drifters, Aretha Franklin, and herself. Also today, we meet composer Carmine Coppola. He's often worked on his son Francis's films, but no assignment was more ambitious than Napoleon, a restored silent film epic that runs over 4 hours and needed music virtually every second. And we have reviews of Don Cherry's new jazz album and of the TV special celebrating Siskel and Ebert's 500th week, reviewing movies together. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Before Carole King had hit records of her own, she wrote songs that became hits for other singers. Carole King and her first husband, lyricist Jerry Goffin, were one of the most successful songwriting teams of the 60s. Their other hits included Some Kind of Wonderful, Every Breath I Take, Take Good Care of My Baby, The Locomotion, Chains, Don't Say Nothing Bad, and I'm Into Something Good. In the late 60s, King stepped out from behind the scenes and started writing music and lyrics to perform herself.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place? So fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago.
That's from King's 1971 album Tapestry, which remained on the charts for 6 years and broke the record for best-selling album of all time. None of her subsequent albums have approached the success of Tapestry, and King has somewhat removed herself from the record industry and public life by living on a ranch in Idaho. And Idaho is a long way from Brooklyn, where she grew up. Although she spends much of her time on her ranch, the city is the inspiration for King's new album, City Streets. It's her first record in 5 years. She told me why it's been so long.
I was actually waiting till I got it right. it just took me that long to accumulate a collection of songs that I felt was really worth putting out as an album.
Do you think that there are stylistic changes in this new record?
From the old things?
Yeah.
Definitely. This record is the first time that I've really felt comfortable rocking. I've always wanted to, but, you know, the traditional image of me is the quiet, shy person behind the piano, and I've sort of come out from behind the piano. I play electric guitar now. I'm working with some of the really great rockers on this album, Max Weinberg, Eric Clapton, Steve Ferroni, Eric's drummer, and my co-producer, Rudy Guess, and they all really inspired me to put a little more edge into my work.
You said you were uncomfortable rocking before. What made you uncomfortable with it?
You mean in the old days?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was like, I don't know what made me uncomfortable, but it was like putting on a new outfit and you're not sure if it looks good on you or not, and you're not really comfortable in it. It took time for me to get comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
playing guitar also helps.
Playing guitar, you're more up in front of the audience instead of sitting behind the piano.
Yeah, and you can use your instrument and move with it instead of sort of being stuck behind it.
Let's play something from the new record. This is City Streets, which is the title track and the song that also has a video. Do you want to say anything about writing this song?
I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I did live and feel and, you know, experience all the things that I'm writing about in this song, so it's very personal for me, and I hope that it's universal for other people.
Let's hear it. Carole King, City Streets, from her new album of the same name.
Gee, you cut it off before the Eric Clapton solo. They'll have to go out and buy it now to hear that.
You've actually been living on a farm in Idaho for the past few years, right?
Yeah, it's a ranch, and I've been there for, I don't know, about 8 years.
Why did you give up the city?
Too much stress, I think. I was really ready for a change and a place to recharge and be, you know, around nature, more nature, less people. Mm-hmm. But I found after a while that I missed the people. I kind of need both.
You got your start writing songs for other people. Now that you've been writing songs for yourself for the past couple of decades, is it easy to write for you?
I think in some ways it's harder to write for me. When I'm writing for somebody else, I mentally adopt the persona of that person, or my lyricist does, in the case when I write with Jerry Goffin, or we do it together. You kind of put yourself in the headset that you kind of think the other person is. They may not even be, but it's your perception of them. So it's sort of another dynamic that you can write towards. Whereas when I'm writing for myself, there isn't that extra thing. I'm just sort of writing as it comes out. And in some ways it's good, in other ways it's more difficult.
Well, Carole King, I want to play another record from your new album. The album's called City Streets, and this is your song Down to the Darkness. You wrote music and lyrics for this. And speaking of darkness, I think this is one of the darkest songs you've written.
Yeah, I'm very proud of this one because I normally consider myself a gifted or whatever. I'm good at music, and I always feel like when I write lyrics, they just, it's not something I feel comfortable with saying, yeah, I'm really good at doing that. And this lyric I worked really hard on. I took a lot of time and crafted it and worked with the inspiration that I got for it. So I'm really especially proud of this lyric.
Let's give it a listen.
Out into the light of day.
Down to the Darkness from Carole King's new record, City Streets. Were you in that kind of mood when you wrote the record?
The whole record, or you mean that cut?
No, that cut.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Was it about a relationship you were having? Or?
No, actually, it was somewhat inspired by the movie Blue Velvet, oddly enough.
Huh.
And a lot of times it's you can write a song by putting yourself in a hypothetical situation just as well as, you know, if it's really happening to you.
Did you write songs before you became a professional songwriter, when you were really young?
I've written some form of song since I was about 4 or 5. I really never wrote lyrics much until Tapestry was the first album that I started really writing lyrics, because Jerry Goffin is such a fine lyricist, and he's who I wrote with all the years when I had hits as a songwriter. I just, you know, didn't feel a need. And then when he and I split up, we didn't write together for a little while, and then we went back to writing together and remain friends. I say split up because it may or may not be well known, but we were married. And so we still write together and we're still friends. But in the interim period, I sort of learned to write lyrics myself, and I never really considered myself as good as he. And to this day, he is the master at lyrics, but that's what I meant when I said Down to the Darkness. To me, I feel for the first time I actually touched the kind of ability that he has at lyrics.
Were you aware of songwriters when you were growing up? I mean, most kids who grow up listening to pop or to rock and roll know the songs, they know the singers, they know the bands, but they don't necessarily know the songwriters.
Yeah, I was to some extent, not really in the pop world, but I went to a lot of Broadway shows, so I was aware of like Rodgers and Hammerstein and, you know, people like that. And then when rock and roll was first being born with Chuck Berry, I was definitely aware of people like him, but he was, you know, the singer of his own songs, Jerry Lee Lewis.
You know, you were talking about Jerry Goffin, who was both your songwriting partner and your husband. There were several teams of couples who wrote lyrics together at around that time. There was Ellie Greenwich and
Jeff Barry
and Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann.
Yeah, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and Jerry and I were, you know, the best known groups. I guess there were other people that weren't married, but.
Were you friends together, or did you feel competitive with each other?
Both. I actually didn't know Jeff and Ellie real well. We did know Barry and Cynthia worked in the same office as Jerry and I, and we also went out socially together. And we really, really loved each other and still do to this day. But it was highly competitive, and it was, you know, that mixed feeling of like, well, I want to get the next record and not them,
right.
Or we want to get it. But still, when they got it, you would kind of be glad because they almost always, if not always, deserved it.
When you started writing professionally, you and Jerry Goffin were working for, I think, a publishing company that was owned by Don Kirshner, the same Don Kirshner who produced The Monkees and who used to host those late-night rock shows on television.
This is Don Kirshner.
Can you set the scene for us? What was it like to turn out songs in an office building?
Didn't matter where we did it. It was just as easy to do it there as at home. Sometimes easier because, you know, we had the kids at home. But also in the office building, just as often we'd have one of the kids in the room. One of said kids being, of course, Louise Goffin, who has had 3 albums out on her own.
Mm-hmm.
So she got her training really early and on the spot.
So were there like a whole corridor of offices with pianos in them and songwriters
banging
out new tunes?
It's by now, you know, it's probably fairly well known, the cubicle situation where we would be in one cubicle and say Man and Wild would be in another cubicle and some other team would be in the third cubicle and we'd hear each other trying to write the same song.
Were you given assignments? You
know, always.
Like, what would an assignment be like?
Well, the Drifters are just coming off a top 10 hit, and we want to get the next one. Donnie Kirshner was really motivated and motivating. You know, he was kind of a daddy figure, I guess, and we really wanted to do it for Donnie. He just, you know, he just kept us motivated and playing off against each other, and it was really fun. It was very competitive, but it was also fun, and the challenge of writing for new people all the time really honed our skills at writing on assignment, doing demos quickly, professionally, and cheaply. Oh, God, cheaply.
Well, the demos are the records that you'd cut for a group who was going to be recording one of your songs, and the demo would show how it's supposed to sound, you know, the melody, the lyrics,
right,
and everything. What makes a good demo?
I don't know. It just has an energy. In many cases, the sounds were really primitive. The performances were flawed. There were scratchy notes on the vocal and wrong notes on the guitar and all that stuff. And tape hiss, because we kept bouncing. At that time, the demos were monaural, one track. That's all we had. And so we just bounced back and forth. So now some of the demos eventually became records because people were telling Kirshner that the demos were so good that he said, more money to be made. Why don't I put them out? So my demo for Bobby V of It Might As Well Rain Until September became my first solo record in that decade anyway. The others before that were not worth mentioning. And Locomotion by Little Eva was in fact a demo for Dee Dee Sharp. And it's funny, you hear it and you hear the drum thing in the beginning, you know, the roll, and before it you hear this enormous amount of tape hiss from the bouncing back and forth from monaural to monaural. But you know, I always liked the fact that they were raw and real, and if there were mistakes and tape hiss, it didn't matter because it was happening.
I want to talk with you some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is singer and songwriter Carole King. She has a new album called City Streets. We'll hear more of it a little bit later. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer and songwriter Carole King is my guest. Her first hits were songs she wrote for other people, like Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, Up on the Roof, and A Natural Woman. When she started singing her own song, she came out with one of the best-selling albums of all time, Tapestry. She has a new record. It's called City Streets. When you were working with other groups, writing songs for them in the 60s, did you usually meet them, the singers and groups that you were writing for?
Not always, but generally, yeah, because even if we weren't involved in the production, we'd often go to the sessions. We did.
What would you do if you felt that a singer or a group wasn't putting your song over right?
I don't think it ever happened.
Really?
I imagine if it did, you know, not being shy about communicating my feelings about those kind of things, I probably found a way to let somebody know or make a suggestion. But I don't know. Usually they picked up the energy from the demo and, if anything, took it, you know, way farther. One of the great moments of my life as a songwriter was the first time that I heard Aretha Franklin's version of Natural Woman, which was, in many ways, not like the demo at all. It was amazing because this was the ultimate singer in the world to me, and she was singing my song, and she had taken what I did with it and did what I never dreamed could be done with it.
And so you were thrilled. Did you for a moment feel like it was no longer your song or something?
Oh, no, okay. Not at all. Uh-huh. It was my song taken to the nth power.
How did you feel recording that song after she did it?
I felt that, you know, the idea of topping it didn't even cross my mind, but I felt that as the songwriter, I had sort of a claim on any version of it I wanted to do, and it would be okay because I wrote it. When I say I, Jerry Goffin also co-wrote that. But it wasn't even a problem in my mind. It was like two very separate things. Nobody could even approach how she sang it, so that wasn't even in my mind.
I think your first really big hit, your first number one hit, was a song you wrote for the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. What were you keeping in mind when you wrote that song for them, one of the first girl groups?
Well, again, Jerry wrote that lyric. Jerry has written, being a man, he has written some of the best lyrics for women that exist, Natural Woman being one of them, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, another one, and one I didn't write with him, Saving All My Love for You by Whitney Houston. I think he was thinking, he did what I was talking about. He put himself in the mental persona of what it would be like to be a young girl thinking, yeah, but will you respect me in the morning? And as far as the music went, I had in my mind their previous hit, which was Tonight's the Night, and we always kind of tried to incorporate some of the chordal feeling and the mood and the energy and just kind of write it backwards, upside down, and sideways, and the combination just worked. Also, I've had, when I was growing up, I listened to classical music a lot as well as Broadway. I had a real good background in all kinds of music, real good exposure. And so I think there's almost a classical feel to that melody and the arrangement with the cellos starting it off.
Mm-hmm. Were you expected to write in different styles for white and black performers?
Again, I don't know about expected, but one followed one's impulses, and if it was a black performer who had done something in a style that was R&B related, chances are what I would write would be related to what they had just done. But there were, you know, crossover type of records where we'd write something for a black artist and a white artist would wind up doing it, and vice versa.
I think, you know, in thinking about your body of songs from the 60s, the performer and songs that seem to fit in there the least is Steve Lawrence, songs like Go Away, Little Girl.
Well, it you say fit in there the least. It just, we wrote for whoever was sort of thrown at us, and it just sort of shows that we were given a chance to demonstrate versatility, and I guess we had it because we had been exposed, Jerry and I both, to all kinds of music, you know, pop music and R&B and the baby rock and roll records that were just starting to happen in their R&B versions.
Carole King is my guest. You dropped out of college when you were a freshman, I believe, to marry Jerry Goffin, who was also your songwriting partner. Were your parents upset by that?
No, they weren't. But interestingly enough, both my parents have college degrees. And so far, they're the last ones in my family to have that. Neither of my older daughters have a college degree. But they weren't upset. They wanted me to do what worked for me. And I did, in fact, go back and actually complete another year of college.
You were writing hit songs when you were a teenager. When you really outgrew your teenage years, did you find it at all more difficult to write hit songs that younger groups would sing?
No, because I'm a perpetual teenager.
Was it a crisis for you when bands started writing their own songs? I know a lot of songwriters felt shut out in the post-Beatle years.
Yeah, I think that was a problem for us for a while. I think the bigger problem, because there were still people looking for material, but the biggest problem when Bob Dylan and the Beatles came along was not so much that they were self-contained, but that they were so good. They were so raw and so different from, we were a little more polished by that time, having had all our training and, you know, our types of exposure to Broadway and pop music. And these guys were like, you know, out there, raw. So it took us a while to figure out what it is they were doing.
And once you figured out what it is they were doing, did it change your songwriting?
Probably, but I couldn't to this day tell you how.
Mm-hmm. After you and Jerry Goffin broke up, you started writing lyrics to your own songs, and you also started performing. What was it that got you in front of the microphone on stage and in the recording studio?
I don't know. I do know that it seemed inevitable. I did a record called Now That Everything's Been Said with a group called The City, which consisted of Charlie Larkey, my bass player, and also second husband, and Danny Korchmar, who is, you know, now a well-known guitar player and producer and writer in his own right. And they just kept egging me on, come on, you can do it. And we never did go on the road with The City. We had we used Jimmy Gordon as a drummer on the record, but we just never did go on the road. But then I met James Taylor and started playing as a backup musician for him. And so I'd find myself on a stage with him. And one night he said, well, why don't you, you know, do one of your songs? And I was terrified. He said, no, it'll be fine. And in the middle of his set, he introduced me to his audience as the woman that had written a lot of their favorite hits. And he was going to turn the stage over to me, and we were good friends and all. And the audience, who loved him, was sort of ready to receive me and pre-liked me. So it was like, well, okay, they're ready to like me. I guess I'll do this. And it just was real easy. I really learned from James that all you have to do is get out there and be yourself and do the song. And, you know, it's okay. It's just the same as playing it for a few friends in a living room as it is for 20,000 people.
Was it stage fright and fear of not being liked that kept you out of performing until then?
Probably. Because I performed songs for people, you know, in a room, a few people at a time. I guess it was just the concept of being in front of all those people.
No, I would imagine that writing songs for so many years and seeing all these great groups and singers record them, that you'd get kind of envious and sometimes wish that it were you on that stage or selling all those records with your voice on it. You never felt envious of them?
I don't know if envious is the right word. Just at a certain point, writing the songs was the main thing. To write the song, to look at this thing and say, I did that, was great. And then getting on stage for me became less of a thing about glamour and glory, which I was actually more uncomfortable with than anything, the glamour and the glory. But it was the concept of, I guess I'm the best person to present my song, or I'm the only person to present my song at this time, or whatever. It just seemed like a way of presenting the song, but to me it was always about the song.
Well, that's interesting. So when groups started doing their own songs, there were less performers to record your songs, and in a way, you had to put them across yourself.
I think that's probably true. At that point, I was working with Lou Adler. I had moved to California, and he was out there. So when I did the album Writer, which was the album before Tapestry, and then the Tapestry album, was just me making more demos, only I was doing them for somebody who was going to put them out there and make them public. And the year the Tapestry came out coincided with the fact that James was going out on tour using me as his backup musician, and he talked me into being one of the opening acts for him. So it just kind of happened. I didn't really think about it.
How do you think your voice has changed since Tapestry?
I think I've gotten better. Years of doing it, practice, I guess. I think I've gotten better and stronger and more confident. I didn't used to consider myself a singer. I would say, well, I'm just the songwriter, but let's turn it over to a real singer. And now I feel that I'm not technically real perfect. And in that regard, I mean, I still look up to people like Barbara Streisand and Whitney Houston as really, and of course Aretha, as real singers. But I feel that I'm also a real singer at this point. I feel that I'm in the league. I'm just not, you know, at that end of the league.
Do you think your voice has gotten a little huskier?
Oh, probably. And I don't even smoke.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Carole King.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
Carole King's new album is called City Streets. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with jazz singer Joe Williams. He sang with the Count Basie Band in the 50s and had the hit of Every Day. He's gone on to have a long, successful solo career. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Carole King's new album.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Coming up, we meet the composer who writes much of the music for Francis Coppola's movies, his father Carmine. Carmine Coppola wrote some of the music for Godfather 1 and 2, and wrote a 4.5-hour score for the restored silent film Napoleon. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by trumpeter Don Cherry. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the 500th show from America's most popular dueling film critics, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel. Will David give it a thumbs up? We'll find out on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Bill Redlin. Housing Secretary Jack Kemp today received a vote of confidence from President Bush. The White House says Bush had talked with Kemp on Saturday about allegations of multimillion-dollar fraud at HUD during the Reagan administration. Deputy Press Secretary Roman Popudiak said the president is confident the secretary can turn around the management situation for his part. Kemp has vowed to root out politics and influence peddling at the agency he has headed since earlier this year. Iran-Contra prosecutors have asked federal judge Gerhard Gazelle to send Oliver North to prison. The prosecutors say the former National Security Council aide lied at his trial, shows no remorse, and has violated the public trust. North faces up to 10 years in prison on his conviction of lying to Congress. He's due for sentencing this week. In South Africa, representatives of two black political organizations that have been in violent conflict for several years held an opening round of peace talks today. More from NPR's John Madison.
The violence in Natal province has cost about 2,000 lives in the past 3 years. The conflict is between Zulu chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi's supporters and the supporters of the anti-apartheid United Democratic Front and the trade union movement KASATU. Today the two sides met for the first time in 2 years. Buthelezi himself was not present. He was represented by Oscar Dlomo, the secretary general of his organization. After the meeting, the delegates issued a joint statement committing their organizations to bring peace to the area and pledging to hold further talks on an unspecified date. The fact that the talks took place at all was progress. The meeting was nearly derailed last week over Buthelezi's demand that the meeting be held at his homeland capital, Ulundi, instead of at a neutral venue. Meanwhile, another 9 people were killed in the conflict yesterday. I'm John Madison reporting.
The U.S. and Soviet Union today resumed negotiations on cutting strategic nuclear weapons by half, but the superpowers apparently remain divided on verification procedures and the Star Wars space defense program. After a 7-month break, U.S. delegation leader Richard Burt met for over an hour with his Soviet counterpart, Yuri Nazarkin. The Soviet arms negotiator says his country remains committed to a strict limitation of SDI. The Soviet Union is also concerned about limits on long-range missiles based on ships and bombers, as well as mobile land-based missiles. Burt, former ambassador to West Germany, says he reiterated President Bush's concern for reducing the risk of nuclear war. The Bush administration maintained its cautious stand on China today, sidestepping calls from Congress for a tougher line. But the State Department advised American businessmen to keep away from the troubled country, even though some companies are trying to coax workers back to China. Barry Schweid has more.
There's a travel advisory in effect. It doesn't prohibit travel to China, but it strongly recommends against it, and the State Department is urging Americans to observe the admonition. On the other hand, administration officials are curbing their rhetoric. House Democratic leader Tom Foley has urged the administration to keep speaking out. But Secretary of State James Baker said the president is quite anxious not to do anything that would hurt the Chinese people. Besides, he said, the administration has spoken out vigorously. Baker's aides have drawn up a list of possible sanctions, but so far he's kept them to himself. There's been no discussion with the president, who cut off weapon sales and let it go at that. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Chinese authorities have reportedly told another American journalist to leave the country. Joseph Kahn, a special contributor to the Dallas Morning News, is accused of spreading demagogic rumors in violation of martial law and has been given 72 hours to leave. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 6 points to close at 2479.89. Declines and advances were about even on volume of 130 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 4 cents. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Don Cherry has played with free jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman, South African jazz pianist Abdullah Ibrahim, and rock and roller Lou Reed.
In the early 70s, Cherry was a pioneer of what we now call world music, collaborating with musicians from Turkey, Sweden, North Africa, and West Africa. But Cherry's new album, Art Deco, is solidly in the jazz vein. Critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Trumpeter Don Cherry is a curious figure in jazz. He's not one of the great technical masters of his instrument. He wanders out of tune and flubs notes more often than any seasoned vet should. But Cherry is such a naturally lyrical musician, even that stickler for perfection Wynton Marsalis likes him. Don Cherry is a free spirit, which is his most endearing and exasperating characteristic. His playing is delightfully puckish, but he's turned out more than a few slapdash or silly records. So even if he plays it safe on Art Deco, his new release on the A&M label, it's still his best album in ages. Don Cherry, Art Deco is sort of a trip into the past. His quartet includes bassist Charlie Hayden and drummer Billy Higgins. They were his compatriots in saxophonist Ornette Coleman's group when it shook up the jazz world in 1959. Rounding out the quartet is tenor saxophonist James Clay, who Cherry had played with in the mid-50s, before he'd met Coleman. Cherry gives his band lots of room to step out. Hayden and Higgins play solo pieces, and Clay gets a couple of ballad features, Body and Soul, and This Lerner and Low Tune from My Fair Lady. James Clay's ballads aside, Ornette Coleman's freely rambling jazz is the inspiration for Art Deco. 3 of the 10 compositions are by Coleman. Some reactionaries still consider Coleman's late 50s music way out there, but Cherry and Company play it with such clarity and grace, you can hear it for the classic style it is, as classic as bebop or swing or any other jazz style that's been around for decades. James Clay may be a more conservative player by temperament, but he sounds at home with Coleman's style, too. He'd rehearsed with Cherry and Coleman in the 1950s in Los Angeles, where he also made a couple of records as a sideman. Afterwards, he went home to Texas, dropping out of sight for most of 3 decades. Art Deco looks back in another way, too. Similar versions of a couple of the tunes, Coleman's The Blessing and Denzel Best and Thelonious Monk's Bemsha Swing, were on an album Cherry and John Coltrane recorded together in 1960. It was belatedly issued 7 years later as The Avant-Garde. The music on that album wasn't avant-garde in 1960, let alone 1967, but that's another story. Anyway, Cherry's new album has a more fitting title. Like Art Deco architecture, the music on Art Deco is eternally modern and timelessly beautiful.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. Art Deco is on A&M Records. This is Fresh Air. When Francis Coppola directs a movie, he frequently calls on his father Carmine to compose music. Carmine wrote some of the music for Godfather 1 and 2. In Francis's section of New York Stories, Carmine had a cameo as a street musician playing the flute. Carmine's most ambitious score was commissioned by Francis for the restored version of Abel Gance's 1927 silent film epic, Napoleon. Francis backed the restoration, which premiered in 1981. This week at Radio City Music Hall in New York, Carmine Coppola will raise his baton once again and conduct his score to accompany a showing of Napoleon. This is Napoleon's March, with Carmine Coppola conducting the Milan Philharmonic Orchestra. Conducting, are you watching the orchestra or the movie?
I'm watching everything. I'm watching the orchestra, I'm watching the movie. I have to watch the movie because I go by IQs. You see, the movie, this is hard to do, as I said before. Even when I'm in a studio with a regular film has indications where to come in and where to go out, and then if it's not good, you can do it again. But this, you only have one chance, and it's got to be right.
What kind of research did you do to evoke the period?
Well, when I set out to write the score, I started thinking about what style of music to use, and I decided that I would go with the style of that time, which was mostly Beethoven. But I did research on French national songs, you know. Mm-hmm. I found a song called Ça Ira, which means it will be. That was the song that the public sang after the carts with the nobility in it on the way to the guillotine. They sang, it will be, it will be, it will be. Ça Ira, Ça Ira, Ça Ira. Then, of course, the great Marseillaise, which I use repeatedly, and I use it in many different fashions.
Thank you. the first film that you collaborated on with your son?
There was a film, TV film called The People. Then he got Godfather 1, and he didn't want to do that film actually, but I told him that he should, because I said, with this film I will help you a lot, because I lived in that kind of a neighborhood, you know, where there was a little mafia around and all that kind of stuff. So I said, I know what to do to help you, and I will write some music. But Paramount had a composer called Nino Rota, who was a very fine musician, and he had done Romeo and Juliet and all of the Fellini's stuff, so they wanted him. And so my son says, okay, we'll have the two composers do this. So I wrote some music with him.
Did you learn anything from working with Nino Rota?
Not really, because we set off doing our own thing. He did certain scenes and I did certain scenes. So we were on our own, really.
Mm-hmm. What had your son Francis heard of your compositions before you started writing for his movies?
Oh, well, he had heard stuff all his life. I am a flutist, actually, you know, and I was with the NBC Symphony with Arturo Toscanini, and he used to hear me practice, and then he used to hear me at the piano. I used to compose certain things, and so he's been hearing my stuff for a long, long, long time. He didn't hire me because I was his father. He hired me because I was a composer, and the relationship was composer and director. It was not father and son.
When the director had to criticize the composer, if that ever happened, was the father at all injured?
No, well, I realized that a director has to take out some things, you know. He just cannot have everything you write. Sometimes the music doesn't fit well, or he has to cut the scenes out. But I was never hurt if he didn't like something. He could say, well, you know, you can try it again. Maybe you may come up with a better idea or something. But he's very selective, and he knows what he wants.
So tell me the scenes from Godfather 1 and 2 that you scored the music
well,
for.
Well, in Godfather 1, I did all of that wedding music. Do you remember the wedding music?
Yeah, Connie's Wedding, yeah.
Connie's Wedding, I did all of that. In Godfather 2, I did a little more. A sprinkling here and a sprinkling there. But I got the... we were lucky to get the Oscar for that film together with Nino Rota.
You said that you grew up in a neighborhood that would give you a lot of insights into the story of The Godfather. Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, it was uptown Manhattan. On the east side, it was Italian. And on the other side was a Jewish section. But on the east side, where the Italians lived, where I came from, was a kind of a mafia headquarters. On 116th Street, there were cafes where they would hang out, you know, and I would think that they were selling dope and stuff like that, but I didn't know, really. But I got a feeling what that kind of a neighborhood was.
Let me ask you, you studied the flute as a child. As an adult, you played with the NBC Orchestra under Toscanini.
That's right.
You played at Radio City with the Rockettes, I presume?
I did. I also made arrangements for the Rockettes.
Was that fun, by the way? Did you think of that as just another job, or was it a lot of fun?
No. I think music does not only become a job. It becomes something that you want to do, that you feel you want to do. It's not the money or the job. It's you have an inclination to really want to write something.
But do you feel it's the movies that really allowed you to do the kind of composing that you wanted to?
Well, movies, you know, you have to be very careful. You know, you can't write what you want. You know, you can't. If I was writing a symphony, yes, or even an opera, I could do what I want. But in movies, you know, you have to remember that the movies goes to Paducah and to Walla Walla, you know, and you just can't. You have to be careful not to go too far astray. You know, you have to keep it within the public.
films are very difficult to work on, and a lot of people who make a lot of movies end up also making a lot of enemies because there's so much pressure on the set. I'm wondering, since so many of the Coppola movies have been family affairs with Francis Coppola directing, you writing the music, Talia, your daughter, co-starring in it.
That's right.
Have those movies brought you closer as a family?
Well, we are. Without movies intended, we are a very close family, as a lot of Italians are anyway. You know, we are. We get together around Christmas and Easter and all that, and we have these big dinners, and it's a feast all the time with us, and we are absolutely very, very affectionate with each other.
Is it a family crisis when a film isn't a hit?
No, well, I feel badly about it, you know, because I know how my son feels, you know, and you know how a father feels when he sees his son hurt a little bit. But by and large, his films have been, I think, successful, most of them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I want to thank you, and I hope that you will all come to see Napoleon. I think you will hear one of my better scores. Thank you very much.
Carmine Coppola conducts his score to accompany the silent film Napoleon at Radio City Music Hall from June 20th to June 25th. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, you're just back from West Germany. Welcome back. And do you have stories coming out from West Germany tonight?
Yes. Tonight we'll have one about the right-wing extremist party, the Republicans, who did very well, you know, in the European elections in Germany. They pulled about 7% of the vote. And I'll have a report about one of their big campaign rallies last week in Nuremberg. It's an experience. We'll also be hearing about the elections in Greece and about in Poland as well. And Deborah Amos reports from China on developments there. We also have a special report about the timber industry in the Pacific Northwest this evening from Alan Zaporin. So it's quite a program.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, TV's most popular dueling film critics, put together a special anniversary show. This special has aired in many markets, but whether it's been on yet or not in your town, we thought you'd want to know if our TV critic David Bianculli gave thumbs up or thumbs down to his fellow critics with whom he shares the airwaves.
Now, from the Disney MGM Studios in Florida, it's the Siskel and Ebert 500th Anniversary Special.
Hear that applause? That's one big problem with Siskel and Ebert's 500th anniversary special, an audience that treats them more like stars than critics. To celebrate their 14 years of making shows together, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert got their act together and took it on the road to the new Disney MGM Studios at Walt Disney World. They put on tuxedos, stand before a live audience, and tell the kind of dumb jokes that they would ridicule if they were reviewing them instead of delivering them.
Very smart man right over here. Actually, it happens all the time. People think I'm Gene Siskel. On my way over here, somebody said, "You're Gene Siskel, aren't you?" And I said, "No, I'm Roger Ebert." And they said, "Oh, yeah, you're the other guy." And I said, "No, he's the other guy."
Then comes a good part, a look back at the early years of Siskel and Ebert, when they branched out from their newspaper jobs to talk about films for local Chicago TV stations, including one public TV job that, after 2 years as a low-budget local program, went national as a show called Sneak Previews. This special shows us samples from those formative years, in which both critics are quieter than they are now. Unfortunately, you can't say the same thing about this special's soundtrack, which ruins almost every taped segment with its tacky and annoying music.
It was the fall of 1975, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was premiering, when Chicago's public broadcasting station, WTTW, decided there should be more talk on TV about the movies.
Two film critics talking about the movies, and this is Roger Ebert, the film critic from the Chicago.
Even the interesting stuff, where Siskel and Ebert talk about how they came to love movies, is destroyed by some hopelessly sappy musical accompaniment.
This is where I first went to the movies, at the Prince's Theater on Main Street in Urbana, Illinois. It's now renamed the Cinema, but you know, this box office, stainless steel, is exactly the same.
And when it's not the music that's too loud, it's that audience. When these critics show samples of some of their typical arguments, the studio audience watching those highlights provides an instant and intrusive laugh track.
And indeed, I found the nature of photography to be very interesting myself.
I don't know what's wrong with you. You're really in the holiday season this year. You're giving out gift reviews. So if a friend asked me to see it...
There's also a David Letterman-style top 10 list of the questions Siskel and Ebert most hate being asked, examples of some of the comics and films who have poked fun at them, and even a blooper segment where we learn the particular mantra Siskel and Ebert chant as a warm-up exercise before each show.
I feel good today. This is going to be a great show. Hold on a second. Here we go.
Peace porridge hot, peace porridge cold, peace porridge in the pot, 9 days old.
For most of this stuff, I give the show a thumbs down. Even when the concepts are good, the production and execution are weak. But there are times when Siskel and Ebert forget themselves, or rather, remember themselves, and actually present an opinion or two. They each name the best film they'd seen since they started working as a team and identify a film review they'd rewrite if they could.
I think if I went back to re-review The Graduate, I would no longer say that the Simon and Garfunkel songs on the soundtrack were instantly forgettable.
For their opinions, which, after all, are what got them where they are, I give Siskel and Ebert in this anniversary show a thumbs up. Okay, so I'm disagreeing with myself. But that's the risk you take when you work without a partner.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's Ebert and Siskel's fantasy of co-hosting as 11-year-olds.
So there you have it. I gave Bambi a thumbs up. I felt it was a finely crafted parable of optimism conquering adversity. I gave it a thumbs down. It's nothing more than a crass deer slasher movie. See you next week.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet French film director Agnès Varda. Her movies include Vagabond and One Sings the Other Doesn't. In her new movie, Kung Fu Master, Varda's 15-year-old son stars opposite actress Jane Birkin. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Dells, the Chicago singing group that's enjoyed consistent success with practically the same lineup since 1952. And book critic John Leonard reviews Life with a Star by the late Czech novelist Jerry Vial. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.